Blog Talk Radio.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
We were shocked to realize that the president had signed this. We just kept saying, but we live out in the valley, not on the West Coast, not near an airport or a naval base. Surely, you know, they wouldn't think that we needed to move too, because we were busy raising strawberries and harvesting crops that would really help our nation. We couldn't believe that they would need all of us to quit our work to produce our food for victory and then be put away. We just figured they were sending us up in the mountains somewhere, you know, to be. And so I started to gather rice, small sacks of rice, and collected the packages of dehydrated soup and jello and things that were light so that they wouldn't be such a heavy baggage for us to carry, because they said you could only take what you carry. And we knew we had to take blankets and sheets and bedding and things, as well as some of our clothes. We had no idea whether we were going to a hot place or a cold place, so our family was quite concerned about how to get ready.
Listening to the Fire Talk Show, hosted by Nell Cole and myself, Mindy Nedefee. Please welcome Lane Ryo Hirabayashi, PhD. He's a professor of Asian American Studies at UCLA and is the first holder of the George and Sakaye Aratani Professorship in Japanese American Incarceration and the author of Japanese American Resettlement Through the Lens. Welcome to the show, Lane.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we get started too much, though, I want Mindy to take a second and introduce yourself a little more, because we're welcoming her to the Fire Talk family, and I just want everybody to know how to contact
her. Here's the thing. I'm a poet, an American poet, but I also have degree in political science and law, and joined Nell recently for a show where we discussed poetry and the power of words, which dovetails perfectly with our topic today. So she invited me to join in. But thank you,
absolutely,
Nell, for welcoming me to the Fire Talk family.
Oh, I'm excited to have you. And you're definitely going to add so much to this show. I can't wait to hear the different conversations that you both have. Lane, welcome to the show as well. And I hope you consider us a source for anything that you ever want to put out, because we're here to support you fully.
Thanks.
So why don't you tell us the best place to start? Tell us about yourself and your book, and guide us on the journey.
Well, I'm a person of part Japanese ancestry. My father is a second generation Nisei. My late mom was probably about a fifth generation Norwegian American. But the Japanese American experience was really always part of family discussion and family life. And I think largely because my father's eldest brother, Gordon Hirabayashi, was one of a handful of people that put a court case up to protest the initial curfew against people of Japanese ancestry. And then he also protested the removal of persons of Japanese ancestry both of these as unconstitutional. And so he had a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court during the early 40s, and in 1943 he was convicted, or his conviction was upheld by the Supreme Court justices, and he was sentenced to jail time for protest. But this month, President Obama is going to give a posthumous presidential Medal of Freedom to my Uncle Gordon. So he's here to enjoy it, but I think the family has been very pleased that his 43 stand was, or his 43 conviction was vacated. So I guess you could say my interest in World War II and the camps and so forth came directly from the kind of family history and family talks that we've had ever since I was a kid.
That is definitely a powerful legacy. I'm so happy that that's going to happen. And that just goes to show, within your life, you stand up for what you want, and you have no clue what the next generation or so will think of it. But you just have to do what you believe is true.
Exactly. And this book that you're talking about, Japanese American Resettlement Through the Lens, is also very much part of our family, our Hirabayashi family story, too. My father, his siblings, and my grandparents were put into the Tule Lake WRA camp in Northern California. And when they were released, went initially to Spokane. Then the Quakers helped the Hirabayashi family set up a special nursing home in Seattle after the war. And the purpose of that nursing home was to take in the old first-generation Issei who were either infirm or, you know, didn't have family. So my first memories, even as a probably about a four-year-old, were, you know, growing up or being in this large, rambling nursing home with a whole range of elderly men around me. And, that's very much what this book deals with, is, you know, after the camps, and, as people got out from the camps and had to come back to the larger society, what was that whole process about? And
right.
I feel, you know, I feel that it is also connected to my biography and, in my case, my earliest memories of being alive, I guess you could say.
Absolutely. Mandy, were you about to say something?
I was just listening very carefully. I'm very fascinated, actually, by first of all, how little this gets discussed. I think in the national dialogue, this piece of American history of the Japanese American, as we call them, internment camps, and that you've won some concessions in your career in starting to alter the language we use even to describe those experiences, but the only close friend I have with a direct personal experience of this, both of her parents and grandparents were in settlements. And I'm really interested in how this I love that you brought up your early experiences, because this sort of wasn't that long ago in American history and very much directly shapes the experience of many Japanese Americans today. So maybe you could speak a little more to I guess first of all, maybe you could give a little brief history of the War Relocation Authority and what was going on back then and what led to these photographs to be taken.
Sure. What happens is that I think pretty quickly after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, there were a variety of authorities on the U.S. mainland in particular that felt that Japanese or people of Japanese ancestry might constitute a threat in terms of possible espionage or sabotage. And there was quite a bit of, paranoia, hysteria, if you will, in the media, where local politicians, some civic groups and farmers' organizations, and some military authorities in the Western Defense Command talked about the potential risk. What we have to remember, though, is that people of Japanese ancestry in the state of California were never more than 2% of the population before the war. So they were a tiny minority. I think from there, very quickly, there was official concern that people of Japanese ancestry could not be sorted in terms of those loyal or disloyal to the United States of America. And from there, the head of the Western Defense Command, a general named John L. DeWitt, worked in conjunction with the Secretary of War, his assistant, to convince President Roosevelt to sign Executive Order 9066. Now, 9066 didn't name anyone in particular, but it gave the Army carte blanche to search, detain, and arrest indefinitely anyone who was felt to be inimical to U.S. security, interests. And on that basis, the Western Defense Command put together an operation. It was called the Wartime Civil Control Administration, that was responsible for the notification and then the removal within a matter of months of about 110,000 persons of Japanese ancestry. Now, about a third of these people were, in fact, Japanese citizens. We have to remember here that Japanese immigrants during this age were not allowed access to U.S. Naturalization.
Right.
We need to remember that people of, this 110,000 included almost two-thirds second-generation folks who were, in fact, U.S. citizens. So some lawyers, I'm sure you know, Mindy, have called this one of the most egregious offenses of the United States government against its own citizens, this forced removal and roundup. And the roundup was initially to 15 or 16 temporary points of assembly. This was done under Army control to WCCA camps, sometimes euphemistically called assembly centers, quote unquote, in the literature. And then within a matter of a year, this population was then transferred to usually one of 10 more permanent camps in the interior, largely in desert-like and inhospitable places. As a matter of fact, as we were mentioning before the show, two American Indian reservations were utilized in Arizona for these purposes. But, people generally spent, probably some months, less than a year, in one of the WCCA camps, and then maybe anywhere from a little less than or a year to maybe as many as 3 years, or a little more in the more permanent WRA camp. And the book that I did focuses mainly on a group of people, a group of Japanese Americans in the camp who had declared their loyalty and commitment to stay in the United States, and who were basically opting to stay in the United States. And the deal was, is if such persons passed the intelligence investigation and they signed certain documents swearing to, stay out of trouble, not to congregate with other persons of Japanese ancestry, these people were released. So the War Relocation Authority arranged to have the whole process photographed from beginning to end, largely for documentary purposes. So they hired independent photographers like Dorothea Lange, Russell Lee, Clem Albers, who worked for the San Francisco Chronicle from the very beginning, almost from the announcement of removal, to being shipped out of their home communities to the temporary WCC camp. And then in 43, the WRA, the War Relocation Authority, which was a separate civilian agency who took the more permanent camp, that was their charge. The WRA decided to put together a photography section. They felt that the photographs were very valuable. And so they hired a different corps of WRA photographers to photograph the more permanent camp, the WRA camp. But also after 1943, when then-director Dylan Meyer decided to close down the camps at the end of the war and encourage those who could prove their loyalty to move back into the larger society, even while the war was still going on, the assignment then of the WRA's photography section between 1943 and the end of the war in 1945 was increasingly to follow these Japanese Americans who were deemed loyal, quote unquote, and who were released. You know, I think in part to convince the larger society that these folks were good Americans who could be trusted upon release and who would work to contribute to the war effort and the wartime economy. But I think also to, you know, very frankly, to, you know, Congress was complaining about the expense of housing, which, you know, housing what were about 120,000 people, you know, toward the end of the war, you know, because of live birth, because of people shipped from territory of Hawaii, territory of Alaska. And also, I might add, the United States subject Latin American Japanese to rendition. And, for example, almost 1,800 Peruvian Japanese were essentially kidnapped with the, you know, under the direction of the U.S. State Department and brought up to places like the Justice Department camp at Crystal City, Texas. So, you know, it's a very complicated but fascinating moment in U.S. history. And I would say a moment when the checks and balances, you know, that the founding fathers had developed really failed. You know, I would say the executive branch supports this. Certainly Congress supported this with various enactments to punish anyone who didn't go along, like my Uncle Gordon with the program.
Right.
And also, I think the judiciary in the form of the Supreme Court did have cases where they could have ruled on the constitutionality of mass removal and then incarceration. But, you know, we have to remember that I think it was 7 out of 9 of the Supreme Court justices were FDR appointees.
Right.
So,
wow.
Everyone went along with the program. And it's an important moment in U.S. history that I think we need to study and remember. But that's sketchy, but that's an outline, I think, of how the thing came down.
Although after witnessing 9/11 and the mindset, I don't know if it would have made a difference who appointed the judges when the society as a whole becomes fear-driven. We really can be very brutal to whoever we think is our enemy. I watched that thing play out, and I kept going back to the time in history where I knew about what happened to the Japanese, and I was scared to death it was going to happen again. And no one else around seemed to be thinking that, but in my mind, I'm like, please don't let it happen again. you know, and it could have very well. The climate was exactly right for it to happen all over again.
Well, you know, in that regard, I would like to point out that immediately after Pearl Harbor, the FBI swept down on the Japanese-American community, and over the following month, over the months following, immediately following Pearl Harbor, picked up about 2,000 Issei, or first-generation immigrants, who were in many cases the leaders of the community. And after 9/11, my understanding is that intelligence authorities swept down on the Middle Eastern and Muslim community in the U.S. and also detained approximately 2,000 people.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us in the Japanese American community had a sense of deja vu, that we were seeing something that we had seen before. And I might add that at the end of the war, not one person of Japanese ancestry was successfully prosecuted for sabotage or espionage when everything was over and the smoke had cleared.
And that's
I'm not
the,
saying
fear,
that,
yeah,
you know, Issei didn't
policy,
have...
The fear-based policies are not based on anything that any person actually has done. It's just strictly the society becomes hungry for whatever they feel will give them that sense of safety, even though it's not based in any reality whatsoever. You can't assume one group is anything. They're a collective of all kind of different combinations. But it definitely was, as I was watching it and watching the different phases of people dealing with 9/11, I was definitely very worried, but doing a complete comparison to what happened to your people. We do not learn from our history whatsoever.
Yeah.
Well, and it certainly highlights, you know, the fundamental rights are sort of the right, for example, habeas corpus, which you'll see violated again and again when it's in the service of a wartime environment and mindset. I was wondering if was that first executive order 9062, was that the first time that when FDR wrote that, was that completely brand new in American history?
That
an executive order like that had given the power to the military?
That's a great question, and I don't know. I would say that certainly the historian Richard Drennan does trace back the history in the United States of identifying opponents and dealing with them in terms of federal government measures, including incarceration. Drennan argues, I think, fairly convincingly that goes back to the United States policy against American Indians. He cites Kit Carson as a initial example of, the roundup and incarceration of Indians who weren't going along with government policy and who were seen as inimical to the American expansion into the West. And I don't know if executive orders governed that, but certainly...
Yeah. When people use the word acts, like the Indian Act, it's never good for whoever is in front of that word. Never. It doesn't and then we made all the neighborhoods beautiful and everybody, no, it doesn't. It's not good. So it's kind of like when they were doing that to your people, they were doing just as many brutal things to the natives and to the African American people. So it's like, who were we not doing something to is an easier list to make, collectively.
Yeah, I think your book is so fascinating because there is a common thread in so far as the language of manifest destiny and that you can see in American propaganda all throughout our history. And this is certainly a prime example because of the use of these photographs, these incredible photographs. And And perhaps this is the beginning of a shift even that the medium of the message, so to speak, was also starting to change, and we were communicating more effectively through electronic media and through photographs. And it's sort of the beginning of a picture's worth a thousand words, and our understanding and use of that, which not only applies to the photographs that we use and show to people, but of course the photographs we don't show. When we don't allow the American people to see dead soldiers returning from Iraq, or what the government chooses to show the American people is fascinating. Sort of the tension between the massive over-information campaign, along with selected bits of information, often that is photographs or these days video. That they do want us to see. It's fascinating.
That's really an excellent point. And I think if I were to rewrite this book, or maybe it has to do with a book that I have to write in the future, I would say that the WRA photographs of resettlement between 43 and 45 are really examples of a new or a fairly new developing genre. And I would say that's institutional government photography. And it's no accident that people like Dorothea Lange and Lee, I'm blanking on his first name, but Lee and Lange both came out of the Farm Security Agency, under the tutelage of Roy Stryker. And I think in that case, they were shooting photographs to win the sympathy of the public in regard to, the folks from Oklahoma that were driven out of their off their farms by the Dust Bowl and the kind of the plight of the And I think that this war relocation authority photography is also, the same kind of vein, but in this particular case, trying to garner sympathy from the public and to argue really through images that Japanese Americans, many of them, were just as loyal and just as American as anyone else. I think that we're talking about the government's intentional use of photography to try to engineer or influence public opinion and support. And I think that there's a tremendously fascinating history, as you point out, wends its way through Vietnam and the whole images, both still photography, but also the newsroom images, the TV images that I remember as a teenager who was the draft age. I mean, there's a tremendous power in the institutional photographs, and I think they really deserve some critical analysis in their own right, huh?
Absolutely.
Now,
tell us more about the Power of Words movement that we were talking about a little bit before the show.
Okay, well, briefly, there's a group of us affiliated around a campaign called Power of Words, and essentially that is to try and critically, let me say eliminate or at least criticize the use of government euphemisms when we're talking about what happened to Japanese Americans during the 1940s. So briefly, we're critical of words like internment, and I'll explain that in a second because there are some cases where internment is appropriate, but generally speaking, to talk about the experiences, relocation, evacuation, or internment, we think of those as euphemisms and prefer to call, rather than assembly centers, to say something maybe like WCCA camp instead of relocation centers, to say American-style concentration camps, and to really call the different aspects of the experience what it was rather than to try and soften the term. Now, I should stop for one second and say that the word internment is a little tricky because technically and legally speaking, the term internment does apply well to aliens who are rounded up by a government, for example, So the initial pickup of the 1800 or 2000 Issei are first generation, largely men, right after Pearl Harbor. And these guys were put in DOJ or Department of Justice, a camp. This is appropriately called internment, and the DOJ camps are appropriately called internment camps, because this is a legal and technical term covering the arrest of aliens and their incarceration by, say, governmental agencies. Now, we're arguing or we're positing in the Power of Words campaign that the application of the word internment to the Japanese, you know, the majority of the community who went through these WCCA camps and into the WRA camps is really not appropriate because, again, almost two-thirds of the people that go into the WRA camp are U.S. citizens. They're not aliens holding Japanese citizenship. So, you know, I would also say that we're not trying to be word police. I think a lot of us, including myself, inside of the community, will use the term casual conversation internment because it's just been, you know, that's the community's vernacular, right? But where we're drawing the line is more toward the monument and the plaques cast in bronze. We really feel that for those, and, you know, those things will be read by many members of the public who may not know what really went on. We're really insisting that for the more permanent exhibits, exhibitions, plaques, monuments, statues, whatever, that we try to call things as they were.
Right.
That's the basic idea.
And it's important to fight that because the rewriting of history begins in the softening of the words, or they're never speaking the actual truth to begin with. So if you don't fight that, then you allow them to rewrite it.
I totally agree with that, and before I forget, I wanted to say for anyone who wants to read up on this, if they go to the National Park Service's webpage on the Tule Lake Camp and Google, you know, National Park Service, Tule Lake, and terminology, they can read a series of about five or six essays that really go into this in a very detailed and scholarly fashion, and I would really recommend it. At that webpage, a piece by Aiko Herzig Yoshinaga called Words Can Lie or Clarify. And she has a comprehensive glossary of the different terms, but I think she really hit the nail on the head with her title, is the words we use really do shape the kind of the images and the consciousness. So we need to be careful about our terminology.
Absolutely, and it could also, you could easily say the power of, you could also start a power of images movement in a similar vein. Certainly the practice alone of recognizing that that the words you do choose have power and meaning, and the images that are chosen have power and meaning, as a way to teach certainly critical thinking and start to impart that. But, yeah, for example, that if you hear the government's coming out with even, say, the Clean Air Act, you should be alerted immediately to the fact that that it might pollute the air. And so there's a reason they're calling it that, and you may not know until you've done the research what it is, but it should put you on a high alert if something, any act by the government is given a particular name. It should definitely alert you to its
and
possible opposite
sound,
meaning.
The more approved you are.
I really like your commentary. And, you know, I'm not a photographer myself, and I don't think I have a very high IQ in terms of images, but I've really started to think through, you know, the process of doing this book and so forth, that if I could work with my students at UCLA and teach them something about critical visual thinking. Students I think are so oriented towards television and movies and now through the internet all the more. But I think, you know, in the universities we've emphasized critical thinking largely as a verbal and a textual skill. But gee, I really see a lot of room, and all the more so with advertisement, for a critical sensibility, which is that we're really surrounded by.
Yeah, absolutely. And it couldn't be more important if that's the primary medium that people are getting their information from these days, especially with an eye towards how the youth are getting their information. And if they're primarily getting it over the Internet or through videos and through electronic media, then I think it's even more important with images and video to, certainly indoctrinate in students a critical thinking pose, because whereas the brain processes words for meaning, and denotation and connotation sort of automatically, you hear a sentence or you read one and you automatically process it to see if it's true or not, the brain does not process images in that fashion. Images are not true or untrue, certainly not at the biological level. If we had, if evolution had designed us to question the primacy of images to be true or not true, we would never have believed that we were seeing a tiger about to attack us. And so we sort of process images more democratically to begin with, just as the very first place of processing them. And so it's maybe even more critical that we learn to process images critically after we've seen them, to start to root out if there's what we're seeing and what it's teaching us and what it's telling us, and what there's people that study this for the purpose of manipulating us, certainly through advertising is the easiest way to look at it, but of course the stakes couldn't be higher sometimes when it comes to sort of contemporary politics and history and what's happening right now, where we are currently have our troops deployed in several places around the world. And what are people learning about that? What are they seeing about it? How are they getting their information? And how can we tell if something's real or unreal, or what someone wants us to know or not know, and what does that mean? So, yeah.
Yeah. I think the example cited previously of, again, I'm a child of the Vietnam War in that sense, because I came of age and was draftable, during that era, and I would say I was deeply influenced by the television newscast with the body bags and all the brutality and violence, and I think one of you mentioned that nowadays they don't even want the coffins being shipped back from Iraq circulated. I think that really speaks to what the images of war and the front line newsreels and photography from Vietnam, they really had an impact on what people were thinking about what we were paying for in Southeast Asia, right?
Absolutely. And our government certainly, the people in the government now certainly learned from those lessons how they were unable to control popular American sentiment in the wake of Vietnam. And have sought specifically to, to treat this war differently.
Someone mentioned it's a matter of what's shown, but critically as important as what isn't shown, right? And I thought that was
exactly
a great comfort.
But now with everybody having the technology in their hands, the government is going to find it impossible to control the videos and all the photos, and with the social networks, they've lost control.
Oh, they try.
They try.
Yeah, they just shut down the internet these days, right?
They hate it because they can't control it. And so they're always trying to find ways to.
Here in San Francisco, I think that BART shut down the Wi-Fi in the stations because they didn't want the protesting commuters to demonstrations on the platform or something like that, huh?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see this year as the weather is warming up and protesters have started to take to the streets again since the beginning of May. It'll be really interesting to see, certainly to observe how in small ways, small institutions or large government institutions like a transportation authority or universities try to control the message.
I was surprised your university was supportive of this. Sometimes the message is controlled in the universities, and you don't get the funding or you don't get the support if you go too deep in a certain subject. Have you found any of that kind of resistance?
Well, I think that one of the advantages of looking at Japanese Americans during World War II is that I think people's perception is, that's a long time ago, right? And a lot of intelligence even is old enough now so that many things can be declassified. We can kind of gain an understanding, for example, of the articulation between agencies like the FBI or the Office of Naval Intelligence or Army G2, who certainly had their observers and informants inside of the Japanese-American community. And I think enough time has passed so that we can kind of get into some of these more esoteric details about how, people were spied on, certain dissidents were oppressed or suppressed, where I think the frustration with the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so forth is it's really still currently it's an ongoing operation, and so many of the details about how things are orchestrated and done are classified, secret. We really can't delve in. But I really agree with the commentary earlier that it is in a climate of military crisis or war that democracy gets trumped, because during the Second World War, what they had to say was, we can't talk about this. We need to incarcerate Japanese Americans. It's a matter of the national security. And I think a trusting public pretty much believed the government and let this happen. Now we can look back and actually see that the accusations of wholesale sabotage, espionage, and treachery were largely fictitious and maybe a matter of, like an animus against Asians and immigrants, along with the war hysteria. I think that there's a political scientist named Smith. I can't remember, Robert Smith, perhaps. I can't quite remember, but in a pretty well-known book in political science, Smith argues that it's a garrison mentality that undermines democratic discourse. And I think he posits that in times of war, especially, the kind of rhetoric around secrecy in the protection of national security and national defense.
Right.
He says that kind of argument is one that trumps democratic discussion. And it also kind of trumps, Smith says that in the garrison mentality, people are willing to give up civil rights because they're scared. And they think, if I give up this freedom so that the authorities can make sure there's no saboteurs in the neighborhood, Smith says that's how this operates. And I think that that's an exceedingly rich intervention that should give us caution about giving up rights and freedoms in terms of a rhetoric of secrecy that doesn't allow us to really examine what's going on, or to really even question whether security measures supposedly taken in our collective interest are really justified or not.
The Department of Homeland Security scares me to death, that whole concept, because it has all the makings for them making any laws they want to shut us up or do whatever they want to us. And then
people will agree with it, right? They'll say, say this is necessary, so,
Yeah, it's, even those commercials where it's like, if what if there's a 3 a.m. call and it's like things like, you know, exceptions to the rule, like, well, we can kill this person though, right? You know, because it's late at night and what are you going to, you need to know this information, so that's okay, right? No, it's not, okay. But we always do these fear-ridden, fear-driven messages, and never there's a time where we're like, no, listen, I know you're scared, but everybody just needs to calm down, and, you know, that kind of, it's never that. They hype it because they get to do all their stuff and spend all their money and play their little war games and you know, win or lose, the people who supply the wars always get paid.
Yeah,
right. And then the intentional masking of racism has real consequences. just as I'm listening to everybody think about, I can't help but think about, I immediately for some reason started thinking about the birther movement as one of the most fascinating things that came out after, of course, we have the election of our first African-American president, our first president of color. And I just remember thinking, oh boy, it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of the woodwork, what has been institutionalized for so long, it may now start to show its face in many ways. The insistence that Obama can't be an American citizen, or a Christian, for example, and their school insistence that it has nothing to do with racism, that this is about nationality, which is, you know, you start to pick apart the code. And this has, you know, I travel a great deal through the United States every year in my car, going from university to university and town to town doing poetry shows and workshops. And, you know, I was at a bar in Wyoming 6 months ago listening to several people have a conversation about Barack Obama, not, you know, the big lie about him being an American citizen. And they all talked about it as if this was common knowledge and everybody knew it, and that all the news organizations were supporting this great conspiracy. And this was just a completely normal American conversation it was, like, happening to run into out there in the world. And I thought, I'm just listening to you guys talk, I thought of just how immediate a lot of this stuff is, how it manifests, I guess. And of course, it's an election year, so we'll see what happens. All kinds of crazy things happen in election years. And it is inherently fascinating to have a Mormon candidate as well. It's going to be a really interesting year for studying intentional propaganda by people in power.
That just confuses the rednecks. They have no clue which one now. It's like, all right, the one that's a strange kind of Christian or the black guy, I just don't know what to do. I'm in the deep south, so I hear all kind of stuff like this.
I'll bet.
Oh, my God. And I just try to keep my sanity and just keep on going because, I mean, it's saturated. So, you know, everything that's happened within your book and everything you speak about keeps duplicating itself. And the ability for this to exist and the machine to take over and target anyone is what the focus needs to be on in a free society. If it comes for anyone, it should find everyone there saying, not here. You are not going to target anyone, because if you have the power to target one, you have the power to target us all. And that's what people don't get, you know.
Yeah, you know, and go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that.
That happens more than you think. Mindy, go ahead.
I was going to just shift tack for a second and say that I think one of the interesting things about your book, Japanese American Resettlement Through the Lens is in a way it's very disarming to look at sort of positive propaganda as a way to look at it first. Instead of looking at it for, you know, it immediately people get defensive when you're looking at negative propaganda and say propaganda that went out trying to convince the United States that the Japanese were less than human, you know, that this war that we were fighting and that resulted in Pearl Harbor, so the propaganda that, you know, generated the kind of fear that would have been necessary to prepare a society to go to war. Looking at those images, of course, it makes people very you feel it in your body when you're looking at it. It's horrifying. But it's very interesting to sort of look at positive propaganda instead and say, well, gosh, this is what we do when we try to show images of where we want people to, you know, we want to reverse the effects of our negative propaganda and make people feel comfortable again. Right. With Japanese Americans, and how do we do that? How do we communicate through photos what it means to be a loyal American? Through photos of weddings and babies.
Yeah, and Christian values, you know, like all kind of Christian values, they put them in those situations where they will identify, with, they do that behavior.
I'd really like to comment on that in a little detail because, to me, let's step back and take a look at the word propaganda here, though, because this is an often held sentiment inside of the Japanese American community. Okay, so I went around with Karu or Carl Iwasaki. We hit the Smithsonian. We went to Texas. We were in Denver. Various community forums in California and then out to Hawaii. And I think that inside of the community, there really is a sentiment that these WRA photographs from 43 to 45, while the war is still going on, are WRA or War Relocation Authority propaganda. And I'll tell you, I wanted in the book and in presentation to kind of raise a little bit of a question about that because, you know, I think that propaganda, at least the dictionary definition, tends to emphasize that, you know, propaganda entails lies or, you know, untruths of a certain nature, you know, that it's meant to harm, that it and is malevolent and so forth.
That definitely has that connotation,
I would really emphasize here is that as I've gone around and heard this from people in the community, you know, who are telling me, essentially, Lane, what are you doing? This is WRA propaganda. These things are worthless and so forth. My comeback is as follows. And I said, you can see how the WRA wanted to promote the things that you've mentioned. They wanted to promote the idea that at least, you know, many of the Japanese Americans were loyal Americans who wanted to stay in this country and who should be released. They could be safely released. They would contribute to the wartime economy and so forth and so on. But, you know, I've asked people in the community that hold this particular point of view to I've told them, look, you find one photograph in the book here of Carl's pictures and the captions, and I admit that the captions are sort of overblown and kind of exaggerated in terms of American values and so forth. I might point out Carl Iwasaki didn't write any of the captions. The captions were all generated, as far as I could tell, in Washington, D.C. at the reports office. But at any rate, I've asked people in the community, you find one picture in there that doesn't show the person it or persons purported to be shown that aren't doing what they really did out there. I said, I'm open to this because I'm an empiricist at that kind of level. You show me which one of the captions here is lying or making up something very egregiously wrong about the depicted. Write me at UCLA, tell me the details, and I'll take a close look at it. And I'll tell you, out of about, maybe 15 to 20 community-based, from D.C. to Honolulu, no one's written me yet to say, Lane, and then doing such and such and everything else. So I would say that no one is depicted doing, you know, who they are or not doing what. What I would also underline again is that from, you know, a sociological point of view, these photos are of what's been called the salvage. These are Japanese Americans who declared their loyalty, passed the loyalty questionnaire, they signed oaths saying that they would assimilate, basically, and on that basis they were let out between 43 and 45 while the war was still going on. And in that sense, they're a special sample or a special sector from people that were incarcerated. But, you know, and there's no doubt that the WRA was trying to influence public opinion with this set of photographs. But I think we need to be careful about propaganda, because I don't think there are outright lies that the people shown in the photographs aren't who they really are or aren't doing what they're purported to be doing, weren't interested in blending into the mainstream. I think they were. So
yeah,
opinion?
Well, no, the photographs end up being very humanizing, right? If you think that propaganda maybe sometimes is used to dehumanize, what do you call it when there's photographs like this that really do humanize, insofar as you're looking at the photos of real people living their lives, as you say, doing what they would have otherwise done.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget that it's the Nazis who essentially we put on trial, the Allies put on trial at Nuremberg for propaganda against Jews. Mm-hmm. And I think in those cases, they were actually looking at things like political cartoons, right? For example, something like you talk about that were dehumanizing, that made Jews into subhumans, that didn't matter if you killed them or gas them or torture them or whatever, right? And that's, you know, maybe at the other end of the spectrum, maybe the extreme form of the way propaganda is used in warfare. But I'll tell you, inside of the community, I kept raising the question of to certain people that feel that the WRA pictures are worthless. I said, let's take a real look at this. Is this really what you want to call propaganda? Or is it institutional photography? Is it government manipulation of certain things? But, you know, and I can't claim I really resolved this in my book, but I certainly, as I went around with it, this came up a lot, and I really tried to engage people. Let's think about this. Let's think through it.
Well,
I was thinking of
the motivation.
Sorry, now go ahead.
The motivation to create the photos, to me, tell me what they are. Like you demonize people and you put them in these places, and within three to four years, they release them. So how do you turn around society when you've scared them completely to death? And now all of a sudden you're going like, oh, wait a minute, wait, not, hold on. And that's the most, but you said something about the money, which makes perfect sense to me. It's not that they cared and wanted necessarily them back into society as much as they wanted to stop housing them. And to me,
I think there's two sides to the money question, in the sense that it's costing Congress and the taxpayer to keep these you know, between 110,000 and 120,000 at the end of the war, people incarcerated, fed, sheltered, and clothed. But also, I mean, these are people just kind of whiling away time in the desert, basically. And and it makes sense that if they're loyal, you want to turn them out there into a labor short wartime economy where they can farm or, you know.
Yeah. What type of jobs were available for them to return to, though, because the level of hate in the society must have been, you could taste it, I'm sure. It was so thick in the air.
So what did they have
to return to?
Well, you know, I think there was a labor shortage in a lot of different areas, including just people that picked sugar beets out in Weezer, Idaho, which is what my dad got out of Tule Lake to do.
But I think it's business owners and everything else now that are now have to do manual labor because they have no choice, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, what I also wanted to point out here, though, is that the WRA, when its policy became resettlement for the loyal, quote-unquote, we'll put that in quotes because that's a in itself, but for the supposedly or the quote-unquote loyal people they released, the Dunkery did set up employment and housing offices in,
yes.
in various cities. And also, I don't want to forget that there were, there were sympathetic Caucasians that also tried to influence the public that loyal Japanese Americans were not a threat. Mentioned the Quakers, mentioned the FOR or the Fellowship of Reconciliation. There were a lot of good people, Caucasian people in the larger society that I think really did believe honestly that Japanese Americans were all right, were good Americans, and really worked in cities like Chicago, Denver, Philly, you know, wherever you like. There were good people who tried to Japanese Americans find a place to live, find a job, you know, find some social or recreational outlets.
Right.
And I don't want to forget about those good people because I think they took a little bit of a risk. And I do think that, as you say, animosity was in the air. I got my hands on a national opinion, a public poll that was taken. I can't remember. I think it was during the war years. I cited in the book. But essentially, the poll revealed that a vast majority of the random sample believed that the first generation Issei should just be shipped back to Japan. Period.
Right.
You know.
So absolutely.
People felt that way about Issei too. Just ship them back.
Right.
Yeah.
What I want to do before we go on is I want to just play this one clip. And then we'll continue after that and discuss what we hear. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's interesting about Executive Order 9066 is when you read it, it seems neutral. It seems innocuous. It looks like just another bureaucratic order. You would have difficulty understanding what it was all about. And indeed, that's true of many important historical documents. Many of them look like nothing. You might pass them by. You might shrug. Your eyes might glaze over because you think, what is this boring document? But what's crucial here is that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, using the power vested in him under the Constitution within our system, gave authority to the military. What he did was he delegated. He said that the U.S. military would have the authority to do what it believed was necessary to protect the nation, and specifically to protect the nation on the West Coast. And so even though the language is very neutral, you would look at this and you would say, well, this doesn't have to do with race or ethnicity. I can't even tell who this concerns. You might look at this and say, I don't even know what threat he's talking about. So you always have to look to the context, and you have to look at what happened afterward. So right after Pearl Harbor, there was a roundup. It took place almost immediately. And what happened was people of Japanese descent, along with some Italians and some Germans, almost all of whom were foreign nationals, meaning they were citizens of a different nation. So for the people of Japanese descent, the Issei, that's first generation, they couldn't naturalize because there was a rule, there had been a Supreme Court case that said if you're not a free white person, you can't become a citizen. Doesn't matter how assimilated you are, doesn't matter how long you've been in this country, you'll forever be what they called an alien ineligible to citizenship. There's another phrase, it's just a lawyer's phrase. It sounds innocuous, it doesn't tell you anything about what's going on, but it's actually about race. And so there was an initial roundup of many hundred people. But then, as Congress held hearings, as there was panic and concern and anger that was built on top of the racial prejudice that was already there, FDR signed 9066. And then what happened is Lieutenant General John L. DeWitt decided that he would use the authority given to him, because even though FDR's language is very general, very vague, very bureaucratic, what it did was transfer power. And it gave the military this authority. So when you go and look at what General John L. DeWitt ordered, the signs that were put up, they're very stark. They say instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. So it's clear who he has in mind. And if you go back and look at what he wrote, there's a famous document called the Final Report, where he explains what his plans are. And then he went and testified, and he told members of Congress, oh, you don't have to worry about the Italians, you don't have to worry about the Germans, but you must worry about the Japanese until he is wiped off the face of the map. And he said, I'm paraphrasing here, in the war in which we are now engaged, racial affinities are not severed by migration. And he said it was a racial war, not just a normal war, but a racial war. And so you don't see any of that reflected in Executive Order 9066. In part, that's because when the president speaks through an official order, it almost always sounds like this, bureaucratic and legal, because that's what it is. It's been drafted for him by bureaucrats and lawyers, and it's meant to have a certain dignity, a certain majesty that's accorded to official actions. So a part of the challenge for a historian is to take just the text, as neutral and innocuous as it is, and to go and look in the real world and ask, what did this piece of paper, that's all it is, just a piece of paper, just a few hundred words, what did it actually do? What did it enable? Because words are powerful. Words bring about changes in the world around us. This isn't just a set of words. Why? Because these are the words that came from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or at least the words that he signed. And so they're not just anybody's words. These aren't just the words of a crank on a street corner giving a speech. These are words that have and are invested with a sense of meaning through law, through the Constitution. And so as we read it, it's important to read this and see that it's necessary to always go back to the primary sources. But that's not sufficient. We start there as a beginning. We don't just end there. And we ask, what did these words allow? What did they lead to?
That was Examples of Historical Thinking, Executive Order 9066, Putting the Words in Context, with Frank Wu. And that was a video that you can find on YouTube as well. Very interesting stuff. What do you think of that, Lane?
I thought that was very articulate. I'm reminded, though, that my understanding has been that it was the original Naturalization Act of 1790 that stipulated that immigrants to the United States were ineligible for naturalization unless they were quote-unquote free and quote-unquote white.
Right.
So, you know, Irish indentured servants, for example, were not considered to be free and therefore were ineligible. And then a variety of Asian groups, including Japanese Americans, tried to challenge the notion of whiteness. Ozawa versus the United States was the Japanese American case, and I believe it was Sindh versus the U.S. was a South Asian or Asian Indian case. But I believe that Asians remained ineligible for U.S. citizenship, naturalized U.S. citizenship. I think the Chinese were the first to get it in 1943 because China was an ally of the U.S. I believe that Filipinos and South Asians were given the right to naturalize. I think it's in 1946, also as allied countries. But for the rest of the Asians, including Japanese immigrants, it's not till 1952. And that's the first year that Japanese immigrants to the United States were allowed to take out naturalized U.S. citizenship. And I might add that my grandfather, my father's father, who came to the United States in 1907, never went back to Japan and, of course, you know, lived in the state of Washington since he arrived in 1907. As soon as naturalization became available in 1952, even despite the camps and everything else, he went down to the office and applied for the papers to make him a naturalized U.S. citizen. But he lived for decades in the U.S. without that privilege. But
wow.
I think it does go back to 1790.
Yes.
So go ahead, Mandy.
Oh, no, you go ahead now. I was just
be in a choir to the preacher. yeah, the Naturalization Act of 1790 is definitely the beginning of it. And there's all kinds of fascinating acts that govern Chinese immigration and Japanese immigration that follow. And you can sort of smell, it's an interesting way to look at American history insofar as
right.
following the money, and the need for labor as it governed, how kind the government was to immigration and maybe telling about what's going on in the country right now following our economic recession and I don't know if it seems to me like there's been so much a resurgence of anti-immigration sentiment. I lived in California for so long. It seems like there's always been anti-immigrant sentiment. So I don't know, but certainly the new developments in Arizona that have come up in the last 3 years would point to this, and that there seems to be a relationship, of course, between economic health and the need for labor and our generosity to people who want to immigrate to the United States and become naturalized citizens. And it's very wrapped up in, and also feelings of, certainly sort of the racist sentiment that often permeates all kinds of struggling economic communities. It's just interesting. But Nell, what were you going to say?
Oh, I'm not sure at this point. I was just listening to you. And I'm just happy that you find this as interesting as I do, because it's very important conversation. And people look at this and think it's just, oh, that's a long time ago. But if you look at the time, these are your parents. These are your grandparents.
Sure.
Those times were brutal for so many people.
Yeah, 222 years ago. It's easy to even look at it as it's really only two full lifetimes ago. It's really...
Right.
Of generations, we think in shorter spans as opposed to, say, like 100 to... But, over 100 years is a possible lifespan, and the United States is still very young, I think, when you think about that. Our history is still very close to us.
And I would say that the whole topic leads to some, very interesting, what I'm thinking of here is like speculation. I mean, students mm-hmm. ask me this, and maybe they've been the ones to influence me, but the question would be, well, gee, what if the Issei coming in from Japan to the United States mainland between the 1890s and, the cutoff for labor was the Gentlemen's Agreement of 1907-08. But what if those men, because it was largely men coming in, what if they've been able to naturalize? Been able to bring wives, or there weren't anti-miscegenation laws that blocked their marriage to whomever they pleased? I think, like my grandfather, a lot of these Issei men, maybe it would take them a decade or maybe two, but I think by the time, by 1940, 1941, I think a lot of those guys probably would have taken out U.S. naturalization if they'd had the opportunity. And then to my mind, if Pearl Harbor had still happened, what would the United States have done if like 60, 70, or 80% of the population on the U.S. mainland were U.S. citizens? Would they still have slammed those guys into WCCA camps and WRA camps? I mean, it is speculative in terms of a speculative question, but you really wonder if those rights were available, would this have changed the outcome of history in a way?
Oh, so interesting. What does the youth now in your community know about this truth? In so many communities, the youth seems to be disconnected from what happens to their grandparents.
I think it's a challenge, and what I do at UCLA is about every three quarters I do offer a class on the Japanese American experience, and what I try to do is cover certainly the 1940s and mass removal and incarceration in the context of that. And I think that one thing that's very interesting is I do get kids who's now it would be their grandparents were in camp, you know, because
right.
I think that it's the third and fourth generation, maybe even some fifth generation kids that we're seeing coming through a place like UCLA. Or maybe they had a grandfather or extended family members who served in the 100th Battalion out of Hawaii originally or the 42nd Regimental Combat Team. So I always encourage those students to go ahead and do a little bit of oral history in their immediate or extended families to kind of see how they're linked in that sense. But I think that I, you know, at a place like UCLA, I do get a lot of Chinese American students or Vietnamese American students, you know, Caucasian students, some African American students, some Chicano or Latino students. And I feel, you know, that it's equally important to have them understand about the Japanese American experience. And I've been really gratified that, that students of other backgrounds, whether Asian or not, will sign up for the course. And I think I've really got something to say to them, too. But I'll tell you, you know, for me, who's a child, again, of Vietnam, these students now see Vietnam, I think, as ancient history, as World War II. It's a challenge, but, I mean, I try to bring the thing to life for them by reminding them that the Nisei that are going into camp are just about in their age range. I mean, I think the average age of the second generation Nisei was something like 19. And so I will tell the students, I'll say, gee, if the government knocked on your door, told you to appear only with what you could carry and slammed you into a place like Poston where it was 120 in the shade in the summer, and then they turned around a year later and said, are you going to join the Army here? We're going to let you volunteer for the Army, and you're going to go overseas to Europe and fight Nazis and die for democracy. Would you step forward and do it? And we have some great discussions about that because I think they're able to put themselves in Nisei shoes. And I've got students who say, you know, yeah, I would. You know, I'd step forward to prove I'm American. And then I have other students that say, hell no, that's crazy. How could they take everything I have? And then say, are you going to serve in the Army? And I say, well, that's exactly the debate that really polarized the community in the 40s and that we're still, I mean, that's still a point of some hostility in some quarters in the community today.
Was that joining the service conditional to some people's release?
Well, no. Look, that there were some guys that resisted and got into trouble because they said, yes, I'll go into the U.S. Army. And it was only the Army, you know, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines weren't taking people of Japanese ancestry, period. But in 1943, the Army agreed to open up, open up for volunteers. And, you know, if you wanted to volunteer, you could step forward. They got a lot of volunteers from the Hawaiian Islands and really not very many at all from the camps, of course, and actually surprised about that. But the thing that everyone has to remember was that if it was voluntary in 43, in 1944 it became compulsory.
Right.
So you didn't have any choice. You were physically fit and the right age and a U.S. citizen and so forth, you had to step forward for induction. And if you didn't, and there were some Nisei guys who didn't, largely because they felt they weren't going to go serve in the Army until their constitutional rights and so forth, they and their parents perhaps were restored. But some guys resisted and got a hard time, you know, Fort Leavenworth and that kind of thing for their resistance, right? So initially voluntary in 43, but compulsory in 44, and those people that didn't go really got hammered by the government.
And the last thing they want to do is go to a barracks or something that looked just like the camps they were just released from.
It's interesting to talk to the veterans because I think some of them were – you know, just burning for the chance to prove their loyalty. So I engage in another discussion with my students, and I say, well, look, you know, if you're an American citizen, what about this question? Do you feel like you need to prove, you know, through the shedding of your blood and maybe the loss of your life, that you're an adequate beneficiary of this status? I mean, I have a lot of questions myself. What would I do as an 18-year-old if the military came and they said, well, you're inducted now, we've just taken away everything you have,
right,
we expect you to step forward and go fight? I mean, I would like to think I'd resist, but you have to remember that, that FBI agents or agents were coming down, throwing these guys in jail and saying, look, do you want to ruin yourself? You're going to besmirch your family name. You're going to be subject to a big fine. You're going to go to jail. Would I
sure.
have been able to personally stand up under those kinds of threats from the authorities to
right.
resist
wow.
My uncle did? I don't know. I would hope I could, but that's a pretty big set of threats.
And it may have been the only choice to make a decent kind of living, because you're going
yeah.
back into such a hostile environment
hey,
that
so
how
you're,
do you
you're,
feed your family and find ways so
you
may
know,
have to do things like that.
And that's what the FBI told people, and they're thinking, gee, I'm not only going to go back into society as a young Nisei who's been incarcerated by the government because they think I'm dangerous, but I'm going to go back and try to get a job as an ex-con.
Right.
You know, that's
right.
That's kind of crazy.
Now, did they
do
any type of mark on – I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. I was going to say, what do you think gave your uncle – the strength.
Right.
Well, you know,
stand up.
I will mention here, I'll plug myself and say that my father and I have recently finished a book that's based on my Uncle Gordon's wartime diaries and correspondence. The University of Washington has accepted it for publication, and it'll be released in 2013. But we looked into this in some depth, and what I would say just as a quick commentary is a lot of people in the community and beyond regard my uncle as a civil rights hero, and, you know, I'll give him complete credit for taking an unpopular stand, and I think it was a lonely stand when he took it. But I would
right.
say that along with his, you know, Christian upbringing, because the Hirabayashis were a Christian family. My father's family was a Christian family, and my grandparents, my father's dad and mom, had converted to Christianity back in Japan. So my uncle had a strong, you know, pretty, you know, Bible-oriented kind of upbringing on one hand. But I think that as a young Nisei, he did go through the American school system and was taught about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, was taught about George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and so forth. And I think when he saw a curfew being applied to only persons of Japanese ancestry, but including Japanese Americans who were bona fide. Nationality being subject to mass removal to the WCCA camp, he felt very strongly that this was in violation of the U.S. Constitution. And in particular, I think that his initial legal argument was around Fifth Amendment rights, that
right.
these were being applied in a discriminatory fashion due to a combination of race and for the Issei nationality. What I would really point out here is that Gordon did have a lot of important support networks. He was very networked into the young fellow students at the University of Washington who were very supportive of him. He was very networked into key politicians like Mary Farquharson, who was, you know, went to ask Gordon if he would let his case be a test case for the constitutionality of EO 9066. And also I would really underscore that the Society of Friends, also known as the Quakers, were absolutely instrumental in supporting Gordon morally, spiritually,
And I would say financially. And so, you know, the picture that we're trying to present is that Gordon did have many networks of support that overlapped, and I don't think that he could have done what he did without the support of the Quakers. I don't think it would have happened. And so I would really say that,
really,
you know, in some quarters, Gordon's seen as kind of, I would say, it is too individualistic, like somehow he's the only guy that steps forward because of his conscience or whatever. But my picture is much more a sociological one, that we need to look at all the networks who, you know, of people. And it wasn't just Seattle. I mean, he knew Quakers and pacifists across the country because of his ties to the Society of Friends. He did, for example, and I don't know how many people know this, go to a, you know, essentially a summer college, a summer training experience at Columbia University. So he and other friends of his from the University of Washington YMCA go back to Columbia for a training institute that did involve exposure to Homer Morris and other people that were nationally and internationally famous as Quakers, pacifists, and so forth. And my uncle had a lot of resources that he was able to draw from. The other thing I can tell you is from a close reading of his prison diaries, he was not in despair or, you know, anything like that, which you might expect from a 24-year-old college student that's taking on the U.S. government. His diaries and letters are really uplifting. He believed very strongly in the both the morality of what he was doing, but also in the Constitution. And I'll tell you that he was very disappointed when the Supreme Court didn't uphold his constitutional rights. I thought that was very charming in a way that Gordon said, gee,
yeah, you gotta love the youth.
These guys were sworn to uphold.
Yeah,
the
he was a believer, you know, sort of deep down in democracy. That's fascinating.
And it takes that kind of spirit to keep us going sometimes.
It did, you know, and the other thing that we report in the book, which we've titled A Principled Stand, Gordon Hirabayashi v. the United States, is that in jail, you know, in the, I believe it's in the federal penitentiary there in Puget Sound, I think it's called McNeil Island, Gordon found that the prisoners were being racially segregated when they were assigned to permanent quarters. And he actually musters tests and goes to the warden and says, gee, warden, is McNeil Island here run in a discriminatory basis on race? And I guess the warden was committed to saying, well, no, Gordon, we don't practice discrimination here. And then Gordon whipped out a sheet and said, well, of the 10, 15 guys that were in the initial holding tank, you know, the white folks went to this block and the black folks and the other folks went to this other section. And that kind of seems like racial segregation to me. And he wrote in his diary, the warden said, well, give me that paper and I'll look into it, you know.
Yeah.
And Gordon, well, I'm going to get in trouble, but my Christian and other principles dictate I have to bring this up, right? And to his surprise, not only was he not punished for raising this, but he says that all of a sudden the strict racial segregation that was being practiced was kind of mitigated, and I guess some white folks wound up over here and some black folks wound up over there where they hadn't been before. And he said, gee, you know, that felt good to exercise
yeah,
my
gotta
principles.
Yeah, you got to fight inch by inch,
yeah.
even in prison.
Even in prison, he was that much of an idealist.
Yeah.
I love it.
Before we're going to start wrapping up the show, is there anything else that you want to add about this whole conversation that we may have missed?
Well, no, Nell, and Mindy, too, I really appreciate the opportunity. And I'll tell you what, if we get this
book about Gordon out in 2013 and you want to have me back, I'd like to come in about that.
Yeah, any subjects that you want to kick around, and just let me know. We'd be happy to have you back.
Well, I really appreciate it.
Mindy, is there
anything
you want to...
And I just want to say I love that we ended on the story. I think it's and I'm really glad this book is getting published. I think it's important to hear real stories of what sort of what does work, what does inspire people to act in ways that you know, certainly attempt to make official change in society. And this message that it's the sort of overwhelming support of a larger community of believers that enabled him to do what he did. I think that's a great, it's a really great message to everyone out there right now.
Well, you know, I would say also that that's what you're doing at Fire Talk too, though, right? You're trying to get us to think about those situations where we can make a contribution for the betterment of all of us, right?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for saying that. Can you tell people how to get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can just text me. I'm at the in the Department of Asian American Studies at UCLA, and you can just Google me, and my email and snail mail address will come right up. And don't phone me though, because I'm a kind of an email guy and don't relate much to my telephone anymore. But if you write me or email. I will get your message.
All right. And Mindy, can you tell us one more time how to contact you as well?
Oh, God, yeah. I'm equally easily stalkable online. But you can. My last name is difficult to spell, though. But my name is Mindy Nedefe. And I bet if you just Google Mindy Poet Performance, I'd come up. But I have a website at thecultofmindy.com. And you can find my email address there. I'm also... much easier to get a hold of via email these days, and I do try to respond, so please reach out.
All right. Thank you both for being on, and it was a conversation I always carry with me. And, again, let us know if there's anything we can do to help the cause, because I'm definitely here and very interested in helping in any way I can.
Thank you, Nell. Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you. Y'all have a good night, everyone.
Attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous, but no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move. This picture tells how the mass migration was accomplished. Neither the Army nor the War Relocation Authority relished the idea of taking men, women, and children from their homes, their shops, and their farms. So the military and civilian agencies alike determined to do the job as a democracy should, with real consideration for the people involved. First attention was given to the problems of sabotage and espionage. Now, here at San Francisco, for example, convoys were being made up within sight of possible Axis agents. There were more Japanese in Los Angeles than in any other area. At nearby San Pedro, houses and hotels, occupied almost exclusively by Japanese, were within a stone's throw of a naval air base, shipyard. Oil wells,
Japanese fishermen had every opportunity to watch the movement of our ships. Japanese farmers were living close to vital aircraft plants. So, as a first step, all Japanese were required to move from critical areas such as these. But of course, this limited evacuation was a solution to only part of the problem. The larger problem, the uncertainty of what would happen among these people in case of a Japanese invasion, still remained. That is why the commanding general of the Western Defense Command determined that all Japanese within the coastal area should move inland. Immediately, the army began mapping evacuation areas and for a time encouraged the Japanese to leave voluntarily. The trouble for the voluntary evacuees soon threatened in their new locations, so the program was quickly put on a planned and protected basis. Thereafter, the American citizen Japanese and Japanese aliens made plans in accordance with orders. Notices were posted. All persons of Japanese descent were required to register. They gathered in their own churches and schools, and the Japanese themselves cheerfully handled the enormous paperwork involved in the migration. Civilian physicians made preliminary medical examinations. Government agencies helped in 100 ways. They helped the evacuees find tenants for their farms. They helped businessmen lease, sell, or store their property. Now, this aid was financed by the government, but quick disposal of property often involved financial sacrifice for the evacuees. Now the actual migration got underway. The army provided fleets of vans to transport household belongings and buses to move the people to assembly centers. The evacuees cooperated wholeheartedly. The many loyal among them felt that this was a sacrifice they could make in behalf of America's war effort. In small towns as well as large, up and down the coast, the moving continued. Behind them, they left shops and homes they had occupied for many years. Their fishing fleets were impounded and left under guard. Now they were taken to racetracks and fairgrounds where the army almost overnight had built assembly centers. They lived here until new pioneer communities could be completed on federally owned lands in the interior. Santa Anita Racetrack, for example, suddenly became a community of about 17,000 persons. The army provided housing and plenty of healthful, nourishing food for all. The residents of the new community set about developing a way of life as nearly normal as possible. They held church services, Protestant, Catholic, and Buddhist. They issued their own newspaper, organized nursery schools, and some made camouflage nets for the United States Army. Meanwhile, in Arizona, Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, and elsewhere, quarters were being built where they would have an opportunity to work and more space in which to live. When word came that these new homes were ready, the final movement began. At each relocation center, evacuees were met by an advance contingent of Japanese who had arrived some days earlier and who now acted as guides. Naturally, the newcomers looked about with some curiosity. They were in a new area, on land that was raw, untamed, but full of opportunity. Here they would build schools, educate their children, reclaim the desert. Their own physicians took precautions to guard against epidemics. They opened advanced Americanization classes for college students, who in turn would instruct other groups. They made a rough beginning of self-government, for while the army would guard the outer limits of each area, community life and security within were largely up to the Japanese themselves. They immediately saw the need for developing civic leaders, At weekly community meetings, citations were given to the block leaders who had worked most diligently. Special emphasis was put on the health and care of these American children of Japanese descent. Citizens, and their grandparents, who are aliens, immediately wanted to go to work. At Manzanar, they built a laugh house and began rooting guaiuli cuttings. The plants, when mature, will add to our rubber supply. At Parker, they undertook the irrigation of fertile desert lands. Meanwhile, in areas away from the coast and under appropriate safeguards, many were permitted to enter private employment, particularly to work in sugar beet fields where labor was badly needed. Now, this brief picture is actually the prologue to a story that is yet to be told. The full story will begin to unfold when the raw lands of the desert turn green, when all adult hands are at productive work on public lands or in private employment. It will be fully told only when circumstances permit the loyal American citizens once again to enjoy the freedom we in this country cherish, and when the disloyal, we hope, have left this country for good. In the meantime, we are setting a standard for the rest of the world in the treatment of people who may have loyalties to an enemy nation. We are protecting ourselves without violating the principles of Christian decency. And we won't change this fundamental decency no matter what our enemies do. But of course, we hope most earnestly that our example will influence the Axis powers in their treatment of Americans who fall into their hands.